Hey, I'm Ryan Reynolds.
At Mint Mobile, we like to do the opposite of what Big Wireless does. They charge you a lot, we charge you a little. So naturally, when they announced they'd be raising their prices due to inflation, we decided to deflate our prices due to not hating you. That's right. We're cutting the price of Mint Unlimited from $30 a month to just $15 a month.
Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month slows. Full terms at mintmobile.com.
This podcast contains explicit language.
So that happened. This week, the GOP candidates, furious at the rough treatment they received at the hands of CNBC, rebelled against the debate process. But the first casualty of all this nonsense was a debate scheduled to take place on Telemundo, one in a series of slights suffered by the Latino community. And joining us to talk about it is Julio Ricardo Varela, digital media director of NPR's Latino USA and founder of LatinoRebels.com. Meanwhile, if you've ever applied for a job, you've seen the box on the application asking you to detail any history of criminal conviction. Well, this week, President Obama ordered federal agencies to remove that box from their forms, joining a growing bipartisan movement to ban the box. Finally, the 2015 election is over, and in Kentucky, the big loser wasn't Democratic gubernatorial nominee Jack Conway, though he did lose. Rather, it was the thousands of poor Kentuckians who now might lose their health insurance as a result of Republican Matt Bevin's ascension. I'm Jason Lincolns with Huffington Post reporters Zach Carter, Arthur Delaney, Elise Foley, and Dave Jamieson. But here's what happened first. Hey, what up? Hello. This is Jason Lincolns, editor of Beat the Press of the Huffington Post, and welcome to So That Happened.
Thank you.
Your podcast, the podcast that comforts you when you're in pain, the podcast that sings you to sleep, the podcast that wakes you up with coffee in the morning. I'm Jason Lincolns. I just said that. Joining us, as always, is Zach Carter.
Whew, just waking up from my another night inside the tent where I live, inside the studio.
Tent in the studio. I love how we're building mythology around this show. We're like lost. Whew. And also Arthur Delaney is here.
Glad to be back from wherever you left me.
Arthur, like me, are adults that live in our own homes that we purchase with money.
Actually, my disembodied voice has no life outside of this podcast. This is the only place where I exist.
It's true.
That would be pretty hilarious.
He has no physical presence in the recording studio whatsoever. I would know because I live here.
All right. Well, Jason with homeless dude and ghost continues for another week. This week, I want to talk about really the rebel sound of shit and failure.
Whoa. Okay?
And we're going to talk
about that. A new Goo Goo Dolls song?
No, it's a Born Against album. We don't prop up the Goo Goo Dolls and their regime on this podcast.
Kind of Goo Goo Dolls apologies.
No, disarray. We're going to talk about disarray. We'll start with the 2015 elections. Cue 2015 election music. Okay, I don't know if there was music there, but if there was, cool. A really, really awful night for Democrats in Kentucky, if not the country.
It's odd that we've been talking about the 2016 election so much on this podcast, but a real actual election took place this week, and basically progressives got mauled everywhere. Like, the progressive movement did not die, but basically, if you get attacked by a bear and you bleed, like, really badly, you got mauled still.
Merely a flesh wound.
Right. The stakes were pretty high in Kentucky, where Matt Bevin, the Republican nominee, displaced Jack Conway, and will now be the governor of Kentucky. And he is an avowed enemy of Connect, which is the Kentucky healthcare exchange that they're using to provide health insurance to hundreds of thousands of the state's poorest residents.
Literally 10% of Kentucky received healthcare under Obamacare. So when Matt Bevin
Zach, it was called Connect.
Yeah, right. Jason Chirkus did this great story for us a while back where we went to Kentucky and found all these people saying, I sure love this Connect. Glad it's not that awful Obamacare
stuff.
That's
true. That's true.
But literally 10%, Kentucky is so poor, literally 10% of the state is currently on Obamacare. And Matt Bevin just won re-election by promising to take health care away from 10% of the state.
Yes, and he received strong vote share from parts of the state where enrollment is highest.
It's just stunning.
Classic Thomas Frank stuff there. What's the matter?
I tell you, I'm most depressed by Jack Conway's loss because he has been one of the foremost people in state government who's been going after pharmaceutical companies over the current heroin outbreak that's been ravaging a lot of states, particularly poor states like Kentucky, saying, you know, the overprescription of very powerful opioid painkillers is behind this, which everybody knows is the root cause of the heroin epidemic. And yet Matt Bevin's campaign was funded largely by pharmaceutical companies through the Republican Governors Association.
And that's a strong Appalachian talking point. You also hear similar things from Jim Webb and Joe Manchin.
Yeah, and in Ohio too, John Kasich. I mean, freaking Chris Christie has this huge video that's been tearing up the internet this week talking about how we need to deal with addiction better.
A video made by us.
Yeah, at the Huffington Post, because we rule. It actually looks nice and is
it
fun.
It doesn't look like crap.
And we'll come to your wedding and make your wedding look good too, if the money's right. So there's one way of looking at it and then saying, well, how good were Democrats ever going to fare in the South? There's another way of looking at it that says, well, the Democrats hide the fact their national game is so strong, their presidential game is so good, and the demographics and fundamentals of what they have going on in the presidential race are so strong that it hides the fact that down ticket, and we're talking about in-house races, and really state government, mm-hmm. state legislatures, county boards, county school boards, the Democrats have no game at all. They have no game at all.
No bench.
It's not just no bench. They,
no organization.
They do not seem to care about winning these races. And there is no plan to motivate voters. There's no plan to provide candidates for races in which Republicans run unopposed. There's no alternative point of view being articulated.
There's no even
they're
real
wiped out.
There's no even real messaging game. I mean, in Houston, which is one of the other big cities where progressives took a huge loss this week, you know, Houston had a sex, race, and gender and sexuality equality thing that was measured that was on the ballot, where it's just equal rights for everybody, whether you're gay, straight, you know, black, white, woman, man, transgender, whatever, lost overwhelmingly, like 60-30, because this conservative campaign turned it into like a bathroom ballot.
Right. Yes. It was this law will make it easier for sexual predators, male sexual predators, to walk into women's bathrooms and do male sexual predator stuff.
And there was no progressive pushback. There wasn't a progressive messaging campaign that really right. mattered.
Now wait a minute. In Kentucky, I remember hearing the outgoing Democratic governor saying, any Republican who wants to come along and threaten to take away Obamacare is going to get beaten to a pulp politically. What's up with that?
Turnout was 30%.
There could be consequences for throwing people off insurance. There surely were consequences when Barack Obama faced months and months of being criticized for, if you like your plan, you can keep it, a thing that wasn't true. And the consequences were that it became a huge talking point that cost him an off-year election. It was a major contributor to the demise of Democrats during that election. So there were consequences. The media did beat him about the head with it, and they paid the price. The question is now that it's a Republican governor saying, oh, I'm going to throw you off your insurance, will the media care? I tend to be skeptical, because I think the media will look at, you know, Matt Bevin's choice to throw people off insurance as a bold, brave decision that, you know, someone had to come in and make the bold, brave decision.
Stick to his principles.
Stick to his principles. You know, it's like the same arguments applied to throwing elderly people off their earned benefits, you know.
Fix the debt.
And also, I think the media has, like, spent, what, a lifetime not giving a shit about poor people in Kentucky, so I'm skeptical about whether there will be consequences.
He also had a lot to say about drug testing poor people.
Right, which is like setting tax money on fire. Also, poor people, drug addicts, they need to eat.
Well, drug addiction, the drug testing thing actually is connected to the Appalachian drug overdose death epidemic that we were just talking about. And Joe Manchin explicitly made that connection. So perhaps that helped.
Moving on to another type of disarray. This is Zach Carter in disarray. We're about to put Zach Carter in disarray.
Oh, no.
Right, because we're going to bring up something.
You're going to unzip my
tech
again?
We're going to bring up something that really bothers and perplexes
no!
Zach Carter.
No, this is Ben Carson talking.
Which is that Ben Carson is an amazing American who is riding a rocket ship to the top and probably will be
doing this to me?
Probably will be your next president.
No,
because he is a super duper genius.
Just don't play a clip of him, okay? If you don't play a clip, that will be.
Clip time.
My own personal theory is that Joseph built the pyramids in order to store grain. Now, all the archaeologists think that they were made for the pharaoh's graves, but, you know, it would have to be something awfully big. When you stop and think about it, I don't think it would just disappear over the course of time to store that much grain. And when you look at the way the pyramids are made, with many chambers that are hermetically sealed, they would have to be that way for a reason. And, you know, various scientists have said, well, you know, there were alien beings that came down and they had special knowledge and that's how they were able to... You know, it doesn't require an alien being when God is with you, you know? And that's really the key. People may not even be able to explain what it is that you're accomplishing, but they don't have to be able to explain it when God is there.
Look, Ben Carson said that pyramids, Egyptian pyramids, you know, big things, those he knows that a lot of archaeologists think that they were the tombs for pharaohs, but actually he thinks that they were built by the biblical figure of Joseph to store grain. And he says he also knows that a lot of scientists say that, yeah, aliens built the pyramids. But actually, you don't need aliens if you have God. So essentially, God built the pyramids to store grain. And don't listen to those idiot scientists who tell you that aliens built them.
Here's what he's doing here. He's setting a trap for the Zach Carters of the media establishment to fall right into. When they come out and say, well, listen, Ben Carson, there are no aliens.
I fell right into the trap.
He fell right into it.
He ruined like 3 hours of my life where I was like, how is this man a legitimate political figure? Literally insane.
He's talking about the Bible. He's talking about Joseph. And it just proves that the liberal media doesn't understand evangelicals once again.
There's not just this talk that he gave was from a commencement address in the 1990s that he gave to a...
it's old stuff.
It's old. But why are you even talking about the pyramids at a commencement address? Why are you doing that? When somebody graduates from college or high school, you read, oh, the places you'll go, you talk about innovation and entrepreneurship or whatever, and then you get the fuck out. You do not talk about whether the pyramids were created by aliens or not.
Ben Carson's a funny guy, I think. I think people haven't realized that.
This is totally bonkers stuff. This is not like someone lying about their tax plan. This is not even conspiracy theorizing. This is just delusional nonsense that comes out of this guy's mouth and has been coming out of his mouth for decades.
We have to acknowledge the fact that what powers the Ben Carson movement, and the Ben Carson movement may just be a scam to, you know, run a direct mail business.
That's for sure, and okay. To sell books.
But what powers it isn't his political policy ideas. And it's obviously not his political experience, but it's this kind of evangelical following that he's built up. And so, yeah, when he says this stuff about the pyramids, he's just activating that. When he says that Joseph came around and used it for grain silos.
Yeah.
That's what he's saying.
Liberal media disdain is the jet fuel of the Ben Carson rocket ship to the top.
Why would you,
if you were building a grain silo, why would it be a giant pyramid? It doesn't make any sense.
Ben Carson is literally trying to wear Joseph's mantle, which I will remind you.
They found dead pharaohs in the pyramids.
I remind you.
No, they didn't. Those were aliens.
What's important is that Ben Carson wants to clad himself in the mantle of Joseph. And I remind you, it was a technicolor dream coat that was red and yellow and green and brown and scarlet and black and ochre and peach and ruby and olive and violet and fawn and lilac and gold and chocolate, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera.
I think isn't that Broadway?
Yes, way, way back.
The liberal media just can't
many
get its
centuries
head
ago.
My mom likes that.
Not long after the Bible began.
This was not the only Ben Carson time warp of the week. The other was...
Oh, well, let's do the time warp again.
The thing that really made him famous and rich, Gifted Hands, his autobiography from many years ago. Yeah. The best-known anecdotes from it are Ben Carson being violent and attacking people, including some friends, including almost attacking his mom. And so CNN went back and talked to people who were his classmates and his neighbors. Well, you'd think maybe they had witnessed these flashes of what he called pathological anger. And
I mean, he tried to stab somebody, but the knife blade broke on a belt buckle conveniently.
That's right.
He tried to hit somebody with a rock, he says.
That's right. He almost hit his mom with a hammer. And
he wasn't able to hit a person with a rock?
I think he may.
How will he hit Putin with a rock if he can't hit any old dumbass from his neighborhood with
also,
a rock?
Anyway, none of these people, they all told CNN they had never seen anything like this and that they were perplexed by the stories Ben Carson had been telling about himself. Because according to these people, the Ben Carson you see today is pretty much what Ben Carson has been like his whole life, kind of a pocket protector, sleepy guy.
And which, to be clear, does not mean that the stories that Ben Carson told in his book are false, but
no one knows about them.
But they can't find anybody who knows about them, and they can't track down anything that he said. And I just remember the debate when he was asked point blank whether he had worked with this company called Manatech that's
in all sorts of
trouble. And
we talked about it on the podcast once.
And he just completely lied.
Yes.
He said, no, that's total propaganda.
And fortunately for historians, this whole exercise, Ben Carson is basically just put a rake on the ground with its tines upturned. And once again, the liberal media is getting flapped in the face.
I just keep stepping on the freaking rake.
Yeah.
Right, right.
So you're calling his passing the question, and it's just more of the unfair attacks. Although, I must say, the CNN story was very thorough and very interesting.
All right, well, that's been Zach in Disarray. Next week on Zach in Disarray, Carly Fiorina, best CEO ever or bestest CEO ever. Tune in next week.
When you're ready to pop the question, the last thing you want to do is second guess the ring. At BlueNile.com, you can design a one-of-a-kind ring with the ease and convenience of shopping online. Choose your diamond and setting. When you find the one, you'll get it delivered right to your door. Go to BlueNile.com and use promo code LISTEN to get $50 off your purchase of $500 or more. That's code LISTEN at BlueNile.com for $50 off your purchase. BlueNile.com, code LISTEN.
Planning for your next trip? Elevate your travel style with Quince. Quince has all the jet-setting essentials you'll want for your next getaway, like European linen, premium luggage options, buttery soft Italian leather bags, and so much more. And it's all priced at 50 to 80% less than similar brands. Plus, Quince only works with factories that use safe and ethical manufacturing practices. Pack your bags with high-quality essentials you'll be wearing for vacations to come with Quince. Go to quince.com/trip for free shipping and 365-day returns.
Cool fact, a crocodile can't stick out its tongue. Also, you can get health insurance for a month or just under a year in some states. United Healthcare short-term insurance plans, underwritten by Golden Rule Insurance Company, offer flexible, budget-friendly coverage for you. Learn more at uh1.com.
And we're back. Right now, we're joined by Zach Carter.
Hey.
Welcome to the podcast.
Oh, God. I just woke up and crawled out of the tent that I live in the studio.
Yeah. I have to say, I really wish you would clean whatever is in that tent.
Got a composting toilet, which is really great for the environment, but it is causing some angst around the studio.
Also joining us is Dave Jameson.
Our, good to be here.
Our senior labor reporter.
No, like, it's actually just labor reporter.
There's someone senior to you?
Whoever it is, I don't know. I do not have senior in my title, though.
Mm. All right, well...
I do.
We'll talk about getting you senior in your title. How's that sound?
I hope I didn't sound too bitter about that.
Yeah, I mean a little bitter, yeah.
Mildly bitter? Okay.
If I'm being honest. Okay. Yeah, just a little. It's okay.
I don't ask for a standing desk or anything.
Sure, no, I know. You don't ask for very much at all, and you know, just a little respect. A little respect for old Dave Jameson, working hard.
And speaking of respect.
Yeah, this week we're talking about banning the box. Anyone who has applied for a job, especially one of those jobs that normal people have to apply for, not the, you know, high-flying elite, would you be on my board of my group of dicks running the world foundation, but like a real job, you've probably been asked to respond to the question, have you been convicted of a felony? Well, now, President Obama is directing federal agencies to, quote-unquote, ban the box, which is to get rid of this question off of the application forms for prospective government employees. As we've seen often, some of the things that President Obama does in his own house, it's meant to signal others out there in the larger community to consider doing the same. So we're going to talk about banning the box today, pros and cons, why it's important to be done, why the pushback matters. Dave, why don't you take us through just the basics of ban the box?
Ban the box, the basic idea is that you take this basic question of what sort of criminal convictions do you have in your past, and you kind of punt it down the line in the job application process. Banning the box doesn't mean this can't come up. It just means it shouldn't be the first thing that an applicant has to address, because the problem is, you check that box, you fill out whatever, and then that application goes into the crap pile. Obviously, this disproportionately hurts, African Americans. So there's just a growing awareness that this is kind of a shitty way to do things, and that this shouldn't come up so early, that you should actually get to know a job candidate before these things from their past are come up. And it's funny, I have a personal ban the box story. This was like the first thing after college, my first post-college job application process. I applied for a job at the Baltimore AP Bureau, and I had to check the box. I had a couple dings in college, urinating in public and underage drinking. So I fill that stuff out in the application. A couple days later, I get a call from the bureau chief. I'm fired up. She wants to talk to me. First question, so what was this urinating in public about? Like, I urinated in public. She's like,
is this a difficult concept for the Associated Press to wrap their head around?
She asked if there's anything else to it, and I was like, no. And I'm like, is there anything else you want to ask me? She's like, no. And that was it.
I'm actually a little curious. How could there be something else to it?
It's one of those charges that's pretty self-explanatory.
I'm just imagining, well, Dave Jameson says he urinated in public. It sounds like pretty typical, but what if it's really something fascinating?
It wasn't even that good a story.
Right, okay.
This was outside Coops, by the way, Charlottesville.
I mean, you'll note I'm not asking you to tell the story. I know it's boring.
But it was literally, I learned.
You were the only person to ever urinate outside Coops in Charlottesville, by the way.
Absolutely. And so that was, I was immediately apparently discarded. We never had any talks after that. And look, this is coming from, privileged white, highly educated guy.
Mm-hmm. Did you even catch the nickname Pee in Public or anything like that?
No.
Old Pee in the Public. So all joking aside, this is the kind of thing that is a dividing line for a lot of employers, especially when you have, a lot of people competing for jobs. And we know that post-recession.
I mean, look, at high unemployment, you got to weed out a lot of people anyway, so you can take that box and put them right in the trash bin.
It's like college applications where you like get the margins wrong or something, and they just automatically throw out the, all right, well, your essay was too long or whatever, so I'm not gonna read it.
It's like a misspelling in the cover letter, boom.
Yeah,
toss them.
If I put my Matt Taibbi hat on, I'll say that one of the things that I think is most pernicious about being part of the criminal, caught up in the criminal justice system, and something people don't really think about, is the extent to which you can make a mistake, come be brought in, told what you have to do to pay your time, pay it, but there's always like a little string maybe keeping you back. And it disproportionately affects the poor, disproportionately affects communities of color. And it's like they can never, ever, ever get clean. It seems like banning the box would be a great step, like a little thing we could do. It doesn't mean that the employer can't ask.
Right. And the good thing here is, Obama announces this. A lot of states have already done it. There's like seven that have banned it, have put that on the private sector that you cannot do that in their states. 20 odd have done it for their own state governments. And what's been good about this week is, guess what you didn't see when Obama did this? You didn't see a bunch of Republicans out there freaking out about it.
I was wondering about that, because Republicans have been really shifting, especially considering that they were for a long time the party of law and order. Really, had they been, they've been on this kind of like libertarian shift to actively trying to reform some of the worst parts of our criminal justice system. But we've also seen, just in that naughty political hack way, anytime Obama does something, you know, Republicans reflexively oppose it. Obama wants you to brush in between meals. Tooth decay becomes like the voguish thing. So that's not, there's been no real blowback on him for doing this?
No, and most of the labor-related executive actions he's done, there has been a lot of stuff. I mean, day of, mm-hmm. they're out there saying this stuff is job killing, blah, 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 blah. On this, it's been pretty quiet. And not only that, there's a ban the box bill in the Senate that I think it's already cleared out of committee, like, unanimously. So there is Republican support for it. And there's, I think it's all part and parcel of like the growing awareness on both sides of the aisle that like our criminal justice system really needs some reform, and that people shouldn't have shit like this held against them, you know, for eternity, and that people should have the opportunity to re-enter the workforce and become productive members of society without their past being hung over them all the time.
Is there any particular lobby that's out against removing these from?
No, I mean, I'm sure.
Big checkbox, maybe. Maybe it's like, we don't want to lose one important checkbox on job application.
So one thing he didn't do, Obama, that he could have done, he could have put this on federal contractors. He didn't do that, which is a little peculiar because he's done that for other executive actions like this, and it'd be much broader in scope if he did that. I think, you know,
there just aren't that many federal employees.
Right, ultimately. Right. We're talking about a few million people here. It'd be much wider if it were contractors. You know, I think one reason he probably didn't do that, it's that he's hoping that Congress will do something. And there are some concerns. I know I was reading, you know, one somebody from like a contractor lobby saying they want to be able to have the box when it comes to like security, you know, high security jobs. Or somebody in childcare, say, that sort of thing. So I think there's reasonable middle ground when it comes to that
stuff.
Yeah, sure. But I haven't seen people run around with their hair on fire about this. And look, Walmart, Target, a lot of big employers have already voluntarily banned the box. That's one reason Republicans probably aren't out there, you know, going after this, is because the business community is already heading that direction anyway.
Well, they put real leadership behind – the Republicans have put some real leadership behind criminal justice reform, too, in recent years. So
absolutely.
I expect that, you know, I expect this to be part of their new self-conception about crime reform. Is there any real impediment to maybe this this becoming a more standard thing? I'll point out just to listeners that in government even in government contracting – they do a lot of security clearance work, but in that case, the vetting of candidates is ridiculously thorough. You can probably, I think, put the idea that some kind of looming national security threat about banning the box out of your mind. It's not a concern you should be worried about. But is there any real impediment to this?
I think the impediment is the same impediment we see with a lot of stuff that Republicans, while they may be increasingly open to this and may actively support this sort of thing, they're really loath to put any kind of requirements on the private sector. So I don't think it's anytime soon that we'll see a bill that actually requires all, basically our whole economy, to ban the box, just because I think there's a lot of Republicans who wouldn't go for that. But in the meantime, we're going to see more and more states doing it, and more, and we're going to see more Republican governors saying it's a reasonable thing to do, too.
Is there any other part of the actual, just the job application process, be it for a government job or a private sector job, where you can see that there's just a part of the process that falls unnecessarily hard on the poor, or is an extant needless barrier to entry for people trying to get jobs from the lower class, working class community?
Other than this?
Yeah.
I think this is the big thing right now. You know, I don't know what else.
So this is a legitimate changer of the game, as they say.
Yeah. Oh, absolutely. Yeah. Yeah. I think this is a big deal. I mean, this thing's been brewing for a few years now. We've already seen progressive cities do it, but to see the president do it for what will be millions of jobs, and to see basically broad acceptance of it, it is. Yeah. It's a game changer. Totally.
Okay, we're back with Zach and Arthur.
Hey.
We're on a highway to hell.
Or a highway to government funding of basic services.
Right. I thought we were refurbishing the off-ramp to heaven.
We're not doing any of those things, Arthur. Oh. Not any of those things. We are going to talk about something that's been dear to our podcast heart, the highway funding bill. We do not have our good friend Laura Barone Lopez here. We will make do without her, wherever Laura Barone Lopez is. We love her.
Zach's been covering this thing as well.
Not even an
issue. Yeah. It's you know, Laura's been doing most of the big picture stuff, but I've been following all the efforts to slip Wall Street friendly stuff into the bill.
And so some Wall Street friendly stuff tried to get into this bill.
Yeah, well, let's recap first.
Slip it in by Black Flag.
This is typically multi-year legislation that needed to be reauthorized this year that controls a big account, a trust fund that helps the federal government maintain infrastructure, literally the crumbling roads and bridges that you hear about. And you know, without it, it's difficult to plan projects and what have you. And Republicans insisted on it not increasing taxes, even though the gas tax that sends money to the trust fund hasn't risen.
With 1993, right?
Yeah, the inflation has eroded the power of that gas tax, and they won't raise that. So they're looking for other pots of money to pay for keeping this highway.
Are there any pots of money buried under some of the crumbling roads? Because that would be really fucking.
Well, they were like going into the super legislative couch cushions and grabbing like crumbs of money all year long. And
like if a bridge collapses and there's like, wow, gold doubloons in the bridge. Who knew? We could pay for this bridge. That would be like, that'd be good, right?
Well, you're going to be shocked to find where they found a lot of money for this bill.
Oh, boy.
They found it in the Federal Reserve. Actually,
I didn't know the Federal Reserve had money.
I know, it's crazy. I mean, one of the things that's interesting about this whole project is it really shows how ridiculous the accounting process is for government spending and how ridiculous the money process is for the American economy. The Fed, it turns out, just pays this dividend to banks every year. And banks, just by being a bank in America, the Federal Reserve just gives you a big pot of money. And
surely there's some like more like favorable way to describe that.
It's like your dad has to give you food while you're a kid living under his house.
So it goes back to the very original creation of the Federal Reserve. But the long story short is, no, if you participate in the Federal Reserve system, you just get you get a payment from the Fed every year.
So part of we have the Fed because farmers were being crushed by deflationary price changes. And part of keeping the money more stable involves throwing money directly at banks.
Correct.
Okay.
So, I mean, originally, if you wanted to be a bank and participate in the Federal Reserve System, you would buy shares of your local Federal Reserve Bank branch. And then as virtue of, you know, because you bought those shares, you then get a dividend. Every year, it's $17 billion over the 10-year budget window that just goes out the door from the Fed to the banks, and it ended up in the highway bill because the congressional progressive caucus had put together their own sort of like pie in the sky hippie budget full of stuff that would be really great for working people and really stick it to Wall Street and rich people. And the people who were putting this together just found this item.
Now, wait a minute. This was in the Senate version of the highway bill that passed a few months ago.
Right. But this
Republicans liked it, too.
Yeah. Well, this budget thing, it's because it's a $17 billion pot of magic money that can be used to pay for things. And so it made it into the progressive budget, which was never going to pass. And then it started getting picked up in other pieces of legislation because people were like, wow, we can just pay for $17 billion worth of anything. And all we have to do is take it away from these banks. And so it's in the Senate version. It passed the Senate in the summer, and then there was a big fight on over it that happened very late in the process this week on Thursday, in which Republicans were like, how about instead of taking the money away from banks, we take money from this different magical account at the Fed, which is used to sort of pad losses that the central bank incurs when it's just doing its ordinary monetary policy operations. You know, it buys securities and currencies and assets and things like that. Sometimes it runs a little bit of a loss temporarily. It's nice to have a little cushion there. So they're like, actually, why don't we just take all of that money?
All of it?
Yeah.
How much money is in this other pot of magic money?
It's $17 billion. $1 trillion.
So is the Federal Reserve going to incur like a giant overdraft charge?
Basically, it has to be more careful about its monetary policy operations if this ends up in the final bill. Because remember, there are differences between the House and Senate versions, so they have to work this stuff out.
So the House passed it this week, and the Senate already passed it. So now they got to get smushed together in a conference committee.
Can I just add, I'm going to regret this because we're already talking about pots of magic money, but if we did use the second pot of magic money to pay for the highway infrastructure bill instead of the first pot of magic money, is there a difference? What difference does it make?
Well, it's just harder for the Fed to do monetary policy. It makes it more difficult for the Fed's basic operations to work.
Okay. And banks
don't get to pay all these
bonuses. So the Fed is going to balk at that and...
They also used magical money for the budget deal that just passed, where they say it saves, this provision saves $35 billion over 10 years, and like all 35 of the billions are saved in the 10th year.
which pot of magic money would Walt...
Routine accounting. Yeah. Right.
Which pot of magic money would the financial services sector prefer get touched?
They wanted to hit the monetary policy part because they wanted to keep their free money that went straight to them. But what's amazing about this to me, it's not just that the Fed creates magic money and it gets deployed for things, right? But that we are now openly doing stuff politically with magic Fed money. Instead of just saying, okay, the Fed can make magic money, why don't we just give it to people to solve problems? So there are things like poverty, which is, a lack of having money. And if the Fed, if we're just going to say, okay, here's $17 billion for banks, here's $17 billion for poor people just because we're the Fed and that's what we do. We could do that, but we don't. It's a very bizarre reality we live in, where there has to be some self-imposed crisis for us to take the magic Fed money and use it.
Okay.
But the banks were very angry about this.
Wouldn't the banks say, like, listen, if you take this magic pot of money from us, we are going to really do some interest rate hikes on our credit card customers. Isn't that what they always say?
They couldn't even muster that argument because this is not related to any particular product. This is not related to the economics of any financial service.
Oh, it's money's just free money. Fungible, bro.
Okay. Yeah, money. Money.
Wouldn't they just be like, we're going to funge it off our customers? Money, funge it out of that pot.
There's nothing more fungy than the Federal Reserve. What is happening with the bill?
So it passed, the highway bill passed the House.
What? Oh, so we're going to fund highways again?
Yes, but not yet, because there's not as much funding for highways in the House version as there is in the Senate version. There's this discrepancy on the $17 billion in magic funding.
How much?
It's well over $100 billion. It's significantly more in the Senate version. And it's only a six-year bill on the House side, I think.
They funded three of the years in each bill.
Yeah.
And then the next three are like, figure it out in 3 years.
Okay.
And they also reauthorized the Export-Import Bank in the House version, which did not happen in the Senate version.
Right.
So they will have to work that out in a conference committee.
So this will all be funged secretly by the conference committee.
Which used to happen all the time. This is a procedural thing that has disappeared in the era of the filibuster.
Okay. On a scale of steak dinner to prion if inflicted down our cows with mad cow disease, how close are we to having highway funding?
I don't understand that analogy at all.
The conference committee will go. It's going to work.
Yeah, we're going to get.
I think it's clearly
funding.
Not going to crash.
All right,
and flip, bust through a guardrail.
And even if even if the banks don't end up having to lose their $17 billion in magic Fed money this time around, the next time that something has to be spent in a couple of years, there's still going to be this pot of money there. So that's not going to sit there idly forever. That will eventually get spent, I think.
All right, budget problem solved. Good work, guys.
Join us for National Treasure 4, Nick Cage steals a bunch of money that may or may not really exist. Hey guys, we'll get back to the program in just a second. I just wanted to take a minute to welcome all of you into my safe space here, to thank all of you for tuning into the show and helping us to create an Inside the Beltway show for Beltway outsiders and make it a reality. We love hearing from you. Your feedback has been such a tremendously good, positive influence on us every week. Now, you can help other people find out about this show that you're helping to build. If you are an iTunes user, please look for our show, subscribe if you haven't, and use iTunes' widgets to rate our show and to leave us a comment. It will help people like you find this show, and we can keep building what we've got going together. So head on out to iTunes, subscribe, rate, and say hello to us and your fellow listeners. Thanks so much, guys. And now, here's something else that happened. And we're back. We are now joined by our friend, Huffington Post politics reporter and queen of Twitter hearts.
Yes.
Elise Foley.
Hello. Thanks for having me.
I am very glad to have you. And on the phone, joining us again, it's always nice to say someone's joining us again. Because it means we didn't alienate them the first time they came on the show.
And you're still on.
Yeah. Julia Ricardo Varela, the digital media director for NPR's Latino USA and founder of LatinoRebels.com. Julio, how are you?
Hey, you guys like me. You really like me. You
we
brought
do.
Me back. My little Sally Field hearts, Twitter hearts, and all that other good stuff.
We do.
Good.
We'll see if you get asked back for a third time.
That's
the test.
That's the prestige. The third timers. You know, we'll have, like, smoking jackets for all of you people and stuff like that. Okay, cool. So this week, it seems weird to say this out loud, but the Republican candidates for president got mad at CNBC. That's so weird to say out loud. So strange. It's like an uprising at the free market temple. And so they had a big debate about the debate, and then they got mad at each other. But one of the first casualties of all this nonsense that we've undergone was the debate scheduled to take place on Telemundo was canceled. It really got me thinking about how it's one more kick in the eye to the Latino community, but we have not really gotten the Latino community into any of the debates so far, have we?
Well, no. All right, if you count the CNN en Español guy...
To ask one question.
About immigration.
No, he asked two questions.
Yes,
one about immigration and one about marijuana. And if there are any two topics that it's like, hey, Latino CNN Espanol guy, we got two questions for you. And one of them, the first one's immigration, and then like 20 minutes later, it's weed. That was bizarre. Other than that, there hasn't been, and you know, I know Univision's going to be doing things. I'm trying to think.
No, I mean, and I guess with this Telemundo thing, they have this excuse that, oh, we're just mad at NBC. We should say that Telemundo is part of NBC.
Yes.
So there's that reason. But I mean, yeah, when you have one debate that's aimed somewhat at the Latino community, and that's the one that you cancel, say that we're not going to participate in, it's not a great look.
I am just stunned. 4 years ago, literally at this time, immigration was a front and center issue in the GOP debates. And it really blew the field away. This is when Rick Perry probably was at his best. The debate was when we were talking about what his role was as a border state governor, and he spoke rather well, for the first time maybe in the debate at all, eloquently about the humane treatment of the immigrant community. Here we have a debate. It's not come up yet. And yet we have these storylines. Donald Trump, we have these storylines. Jeb and Marco.
Right.
You can't really have these storylines, these essential dramatic moments in the undercurrent without bringing immigration to the fore. And yet, I don't feel like we have.
And I think an important thing with this is that I just don't think the non-Spanish language outlets do as good a job reporting on immigration as Telemundo and Univision do.
No,
I mean,
except for you,
they just know it so much better.
yeah, no, it's true.
And so the questions that you would get if you have those moderators are going to be different and I think better than a bunch of people saying, can you please restate your support for border security?
Julio, let me ask you this, because this might be like a key way of separating the kind of work that Telemundo and Univision would do versus CNN. Do people actively involved in politics in the Latino community harbor a great desire to walk up to presidential candidates and ask them five questions about the hot gaffe of the week? Or are there actually relevant issues to your community that perhaps people outside of the community might want to hear about?
Yeah, no, I, that's an excellent question, and it's actually
Thank
one
you.
Of the things. Yeah, no, this is good, and I'm going to give you, you know, it's one of the things we're actually discussing in Latino USA about the Latino vote and about actual issues outside of immigration. And we're actually dropping that that podcast this weekend. But it's exactly the question that people need to be asking. What is the predominantly Spanish language speaking community, which continues to grow? And guess what? They're voters, despite of what, you know, people like Donald Trump or his supporters might think. There has been a tradition of journalism, of Spanish language journalism, that is a little bit more closer to the ground. And I think, Elise, you make a really good point. The history of Univision and Telemundo talking about issues that pertain to the local community. And that's kind of been going under the radar for years. I think this whole issue of asking substantive questions, asking real policy questions, it's just not being covered in the mainstream English language debates. When you look at some of the journalists in Spanish language TV, that type of discussion does happen more. In addition, it's almost like what's to lose for the Republicans to just say, like, yeah, we'll be on Telemundo. It's going to look good if you were on symbolically, but by saying no, it's just kind of adding more fuel to the fire. You know, these are not second-class reporters. These are actual, like, serious journalists. It's just mind-boggling. You know, was that too passionate for you guys?
No, that's perfectly fine.
Am I coming back on after that?
No, that's great.
And I would say that, as, you know, has been noted a million times, including by Republican candidates, and correctly, immigration is not the only issue to Latino voters. So if they go on and talk to a Latino audience, they're also talking about the economy and education and all these things they want to talk about. So, you know, it's not like they would just be pummeled on something for 2 hours.
But I want to move on and talk about someone who obviously doesn't care about caring a brief for the Latino community, Donald Trump. And here's a controversial thing. It's dividing communities. I can say that in my household, my wife and I have two different opinions in this. But Donald Trump is hosting Saturday Night Live. And this has become a flashpoint because NBC did say that because of what Donald Trump said about the Latino community, they were going to cut ties with him. They've really got a weird, flexible definition of what ties represent.
Oh, they cut ties for what? 4 months?
For a minute. I think they literally cut like four Donald Trump neckties. But he's hosting SNL. Julio, you've written the Guardian about this.
Right.
Tell me your mood on this.
Here's the thing about the whole Trump SNL piece, and I did write an op-ed that was well-received in the Guardian about, you know, how Latinos are reacting. This is really a symbolic type of, I would say, protest or movement or whatever is being organized. It's the notion of taking the Trump as reality star, you know, megastar, that he's going to get attention no matter what, and putting him in a show that has had such an atrocious track record when it comes to attracting Latino talent. I mean, we're talking about New York City in a place that, you know, where there's a strong Latino comedy presence. You know, 40 years and you have Horatio Sanz and Fred Armisen and no Latina. You know, I can think of, like, in the top of my head, you know, John Leguizamo, Al Madrigal, George Lopez. You know, those three come to mind just immediately. You know, Cristel Alonso. Like, there's so many, like, talented Latinos out there who could be on Saturday Night Live. So if you mix sort of the pop culture, like, symbolism of what Saturday Night Live says, and I said it was, you know, everything that is white and elite in America, and then merge it with the guy who said what he said, and then NBC sends a memo saying, we're done, we're cutting ties with Donald Trump out of respect and dignity, and here you are putting him as a host in a high-profile show that is all for a ratings grab. There's nothing else. So when people say, like, oh, Latinos are giving Trump attention and making him more relevant, I mean, he's still in the polls. He's still up there. He's a media genius. So you might as well have Latino groups join that media spotlight. So at least you're starting to have conversations that we're having now. And I think people are overthinking the whole, like, censorship, free speech, and all that.
Yeah, there are people who think that you literally want to shut Saturday Night Live down.
Yeah, and I think if you really start talking to the organizers, it really is about political voice. If that's going to engage people, I mean, this is going to be my ideal, like, my idealistic moment. It's good for democracy. And people go, like, you know, it's like people go, oh, Julio's being ideal, but that's, I mean, I kind of believe that.
I'll say this, another New York tradition, and NBC News, they've promoted this. their facility, Rockefeller Plaza, is an agora for public comment and debate. They present it as such. And so it is an area where the spotlight shines, and it is a place where robust public debate happens, and that's great. I've seen comedians move from just being comedians to sort of being lionized for saying things that have like sort of this populist appeal, this political appeal. And I see the internet, their new tendency is to try to make saints out of comedians. And this issue is tough for me because I think that it's very, I think that SNL does have a bad track record with Latinos. That goes without saying. They've barely used them in the cast. They rarely invite them to host. I don't think there hasn't been a lot of depth to the sketches that involve Latinos. At the same time, I just think that comedians, if you look to them for your avatars of social justice, they're going to let you down, man. They're going to let you down. Their incentives are completely different. So when my wife and I argue about this, she says, I'm not sure about Donald Trump hosting SNL. I think it's wrong. And I say, I'm not sure about Donald Trump hosting SNL. I think it's risky. I think that SNL's job is to write funny jokes. And I don't think, I'm skeptical about whether this will be funny.
Well, and I think that there's, I mean, I could be wrong, but no real choice but to address this somehow on the show by
Absolutely.
Having some sort of skit that acknowledges all this stuff. And I just think, like, I don't know, if you have a skit with him talking about deporting a bunch of people and all those people are white people, it's not going to look great.
But this is why you gather outside Rockefeller Center, to influence this stuff.
I actually grew up in the 70s, guys.
Yeah, this is a great time to grow up, man.
Chico Escuela. You know, I always say, like, Saturday Night Live, when it comes to Latinos, has always been about Chico Escuela, which was the Garrett Morris character who gets up and goes, like, baseball been very, very good to me. And I saw that when I was, like, 8 years old, and I was kind of like, I was a huge Roberto Clemente fan, and I remember telling my mom in the Bronx, I'm like, Mom, like, this is stupid. Like, I was 8, and I've actually done, I mean, I've worked in comedy. I do improv. I've been doing it for decades. So for me, it's like, I do think, Elise, that if they actually did that, it would just, I mean, that's exactly the problem, is that they're going to, if they do address something like that with Trump, they're going to address it from the white elite, like, you know, we don't understand Latinos. It's really always been a caricature. So we're going to do it, and it's going to be like, you know, the joke in the room, like the frat boy joke in the room, and it's going to backfire, and they've done that in the past.
Yeah.
And so that's what I fear. He's going to do it, and like I said, the best thing that's come out of this is, like, you have all these Latino organizations that have not really worked together, and they're working together to kind of put some more agency to the political voice, and I still think that's a great thing.
So that's what happened this week. This podcast was produced, edited, and engineered by Adriana Usero and Peter James Callahan, with technical assistance from Christine Canetta and spiritual guidance from Caitlin Boguki, Khaleesi, mother of podcasts. I'm Jason Linkins, and this week we were joined by digital media director of NPR's Latino USA and LatinoRebels.com founder Julio Ricardo Varela, as well as Huffington Post reporters Zach Carter, Arthur Delaney, Elise Foley, and Dave Jameson. So That Happened is available on iTunes at itunes.com/sothathappened. Check out the whole family of Huffington Post podcasts in the iTunes store while you're there. Subscribe and tell your friends. If there's something you'd like to hear us talk about, please send an email to sothathappened@huffingtonpost.com. As always, we thank you for listening, and we miss you already.